wake up. It's time to count them down. The Chaz and AJ Top 10.
We are doing the countdown.
Yes.
It's Top 10 Eyeball Problems That Bring Patients to the ER. Dr. Ron Clark, Associate Chief of Emergency Medicine, the Hospital of Central Connecticut, New Britain General Campus, on the phone. And let's go right to the phones. Pollingford.
Morning, guys.
Morning.
Hi. Monday?
Morning.
I'm going to go with foreign objects. Got quite a few of those in my eye.
Absolutely. Foreign bodies is on the list. That was my number 8. You can get all kinds of things in your eye. Makeup, eyelashes, wood, metal.
Fingernails.
You can get fingernails. Yes, AJ, you are correct. that's very common, so we have to go fishing for them. Sometimes we have to use a little needle to kind of flip them out. Sometimes I can use tissue or other things to do that. Yeah, that's definitely on the list. It's number 8. My wife actually thought she had a contact in her eye that was in the back. People get worried about that. We were contacts. I had to actually make a special appointment. It was after hours, and I didn't want to bring her to the ER because I couldn't see it, and I'm pretty good about, I can, Chaz, like, evert your lid and do all kinds of fancy tricks so it looks like your eyeball's coming out of your eye to really look at my wife's eye. Didn't see the contact. She assured me that it was in there and it was lost, so I call the eye doctor, you know, pull the doctor card, they make an appointment, and we go into the office. He looks. He's like, there's no contact in the eye. And we ended up going home, and then she gets home, and it's on the floor.
Oh. Found it.
We got back to the house. And she goes, literally sitting on the floor. She saw a little glare of the contact.
So did it fall out while you were doing all those eye maneuvers?
At all. I think it was, I think she must have kind of either scratched her eye a little bit or something. I think it was already out. I don't think it was in what it was. But I think something must have happened. It's definitely possible that it flipped out when I flipped her eyelid up, like, inside out. So it's possible. I don't think it was there to start with.
Like a frisbee.
But when someone says there's something in there and I don't want to go to sleep with it stuck in the back of my eye and all kinds of stuff.
Especially when it's your wife.
Yeah, you see your soul.
It's my wife. And then I'm pretty good at looking to see, and it's not there, and she's telling me it is. Happens all the time in the ER when people are sure that something's there that's actually not, and they're convinced. And so then all of a sudden I was questioning myself, said, why don't I just have the eye doctor take a look? And he did the same thing. He's like, it's not in there.
So. Thank you, Pollingford. We did a dumbass news story a few weeks back where there was a woman who went to an eye doctor with the same problem, but they found 5 contact lenses behind her eye.
She was loaded for the week.
Man. Layer like an onion.
Yeah.
They can go back there and get stuck. I mean, people think there's a membrane back there on the back side of your eye, so it's not going to go like all the way to your brain, but they're small little things, and they can get stuck back there. Depending on what kind of contacts you have, you don't want them stuck there for too long because you can cause an eye infection and other problems too if they're in the wrong spot.
Sneezes are shooting out.
Joe in New Haven.
Hey, how you doing? A corneal abrasion.
Yes, it is on my list. The corneal abrasion is very common. It's number 4 on the list. A lot of people can get scratches in their eyes. They are very painful when you get them. And we have a stain. It's called fluorescein that goes in their eye. I take a little bit of tetracaine, which is a numbing medication. I literally put a drop on the fluorescein, and it makes your eye look green under a woods lamp, under a blue light, and then I can literally see where it's scraped. Like the dye uptakes into the corneal abrasion, and then most people need to be on antibiotics for a week and it usually heals, but yes, they can be very painful when people get them. Their eyes usually red and tearing and stuff, and
keep it open.
Yeah
you can't even keep it open.
My eyes closed. I had a piece of hay stuck in it up in Vermont. We went into a farm area. And I kept rubbing it, and that was the worst thing to do.
It was the absolute worst thing to do, yep. And if you get the hay in there, and then it's just abrading your eye. People can get sand in their eye, hay, all kinds of things. Yeah, very, very painful and very common reason why people come to the ER. That's one of the most common eye complaints that we have, are that my eye is hurting. You know, I think I got something in there, and then I scratched it, or the material scratched my cornea. And, yeah, they can be very painful. So I give people, you know, the pain medication. We also use erythromycin or other kinds of eye ointments for antibiotics, too, so you don't get an infection.
Hey, thank you, Joe.
Can't get a drop in there.
We were talking the last one. It was like contacts and foreign items, and you mentioned makeup.
Yeah, you can get, like mascara and stuff in your eye, like chunks of it that get in your eye.
The eyeliner.
Yeah, eyeliner.
Mm-hmm.
Wood. There's all kinds of
wood.
Fake eyelashes. Like they get stuck. Like a piece of the fake eyelash will get stuck in their eye. People can have metal. Welders get something called a rust ring when they don't put their facial shield down. If there's any listeners, they know what I'm talking about because I take care of like a couple, at least a few a year, where you have to wear your facial shield when you're welding. And some people, for that last little bit, they already flip their shield up and they just do one more spark with the flash.
It's always that one more.
Yep.
Those are called flash burns. So that gives you a really bad burn on your eye that needs special medication for as well. So, yeah, and people can get, like, metal in their eye, like if they're hitting into something. And then they can get, if metal goes in your eye, it makes a little rust ring. Actually, your eye starts to try to wall it off, and you can see a little ring around it. But, yeah, there's lots of things that go in people's eye. I mean,
that's wild.
Come here, Rusty.
A nail that was in someone's eye.
A nail!
Shot into their eye.
Oh!
Like when they were walking. That was a number of years ago, but, yeah, that was a
good nailed it.
X-ray. Yeah.
Wait,
they nailed it, exactly. They did.
The nail went into the eye?
Into the eye.
Point first.
They were running with a nail gun with their hand on it and fell into it, but face first with the nail gun.
That is horrifying. Oh my God.
1001 uses now.
Most people come see me. It's their worst day. Like, it's a bad day, and if they just stayed in bed, they would have been better off.
Top 10 eyeball problems that bring patients to the ER. Dr. Ron Clark doing the list. What did we get so far?
So far we got number 4, corneal abrasion, and number 8, foreign body in the eye.
Emma.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'm going to go with an orbital fracture.
Yeah, so eye trauma is definitely on the list. I'll give you credit for that. It's the number 9. You can have any kind of orbital fracture. You can have an orbital floor fracture, a sidewall fracture. Some people can get ruptured globes where their eye actually deflates from having trauma.
Oh.
Yeah, that's number 9 on our list. The important thing with any kind of orbital fracture, which is the orbit's the bone of the skull that holds the eyeball, is that you don't want the eye muscles to get entrapped because then you need surgery. As long as the fracture doesn't entrap the eye muscles, then usually you don't need surgery. And the way I tell is I ask you to look up, down, and left and right, and if you can't move one of those directions, that means the eye muscle is stuck in the fracture.
Oh.
And then you need a relatively emergent surgery. Yeah, with an eye doctor. So yeah, it's on the list. That's a number 9, eye trauma.
Everything he said in the last, 25 minutes has grossed me out.
You have to be a certain type of person to do my, you have to not worry about blood, puke, bad things, things falling off, broken things.
But on top of that, you need to be wicked smart and good with people.
Right.
Yes. Yes, it's a unique combination to be a ER doc, and you know where I work, most of the guys are smart. Most of them are kind of tough, like they're not squeamish.
Look at what dummies on the floor.
Yeah, but it's a unique individual to work in the ER. Plus, remember, there's the pressure side of it too, Chaz. The fact that people are coming in, they're all strangers. They're coming in with their diagnosis, and I have to quickly, or they're coming with their concern, and I have to quickly make a diagnosis. It's a lot of pressure there too, just to make the right diagnosis.
Yeah, you don't have a, let me think about this for a couple of days, and I'll get back to you.
I'm going to sleep on this for a while.
Oh, by the way, as soon as you're done, there's another person waiting right away.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Oh, man.
Sometimes more than one person.
Oh, man.
What do ER docs make? What's the start, and then what's a high-end ER doc?
So it depends on the part of the country. In Connecticut, the average ER doctor probably makes $350,000.
Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But if you go down south, they make a lot more, maybe $400,000 or $500,000.
Wow.
Depends on the area of the country. And then if you go out west, it depends on where you're at. Some of the places like Seattle, which you would think would pay high, everybody wants to go there. So they make $200,000.
Really?
So it's
weird.
It is very dependent. So I have friends that I've had since residency who are what we call firefighters. They're locums, which means they travel, and they literally go to the highest bidder. And for emergency medicine, because I'm like a factory worker, it's just an hourly rate. they just go where the highest rate is. They might go to Alaska, or they might go to Wyoming or Texas or somewhere, and they just go on short contracts of who pays the most, because in their mind, the hours are the hours no matter where you work, and get a higher rate. There's all different, you know, medicine is an interesting thing for salaries. Just, you know, some people make $100,000, some people make $1 million, like the surgeons and plastics and those kinds of things. There's a whole range, but a lot of it's based on demand.
If the average in Connecticut is $350, I hope you're making like $1 million.
Seriously.
I wish I
would.
Yeah.
You're doing an awful lot.
Real.
Man. Emma, thank you. Joe the Bellman, what do you think?
Good morning, everybody. Good morning, Doc.
Good morning.
You mentioned flash burn or a steam burn. I've been treated for that myself.
Yeah, we put those under the abrasions too. And the flash burns can definitely cause trauma. Again, the welding ones are the big ones that we see in the ER that can be very painful too. And you get your eye tearing and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, it's on the list. And burns have special medications, sometimes antibiotics. People need a tetanus shot. There's a whole kind of order of things that we do for them.
Definitely tetanus.
Yeah. Yep, and they're very painful, as you know.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Have a great day.
Ken in Oxford.
Hey, good morning. Happy Monday. How about if you get like a chemical in your eye, like a chemical burn?
Ooh. Yep. So I'll give you, that's number one on the list, was conjunctivitis. And there's different kinds of conjunctivitis, chemical conjunctivitis, bacterial, viral. So, you know, if you get chemicals in your eyes, it depends on if it's an acid or a base. We have an eye flush station where they literally flood your eye with water. We can also put in something called a Morgan lens, which are little plastic lenses that go in both your eyes. And then I put a liter of normal saline into your eyes relatively quickly. You really, particularly with certain chemicals, you want to flush out the eye as quick as you can so it doesn't cause any burn or injury. And then some people can have, you know, viral or bacterial conjunctivitis. Conjunctivitis is just inflammation of the conjunctiva, which is the layering of the eye, the outer layer of the eye.
Oh.
So sometimes those need antibiotics, too, depending on what the cause is. If it's viral, we don't use antibiotics. If it's bacterial and you have a lot of, like, yellow or green goop coming out of your eyes, then usually I use some antibiotics for that.
Okay. I don't want lunch anymore.
Right. I was working in a factory when I was 18. And we were putting these, aluminum panels together.
Okay.
And it included gluing and then riveting.
Yeah.
And then the gluing part, you had to clean the panel and clean the extrusion so the glue would
adhere.
Yeah. And I got a drop of that cleaner in my eye.
Did it burn?
Day over.
No, yeah. I heard
week
it.
Over.
I heard it. And there was like a little divot where the drop hit.
Oh, yeah.
So I went to the emergency. I have really, like, took a part of my eye and said, it's gone.
Oh, I'm finished.
Like, poof, foot. Yeah. And now it's gone.
Right. Damn.
But it's back now. Is that weird?
All right. Like, we're back.
I don't still have a divot. Is that weird, Doc?
You can heal. You can heal from them. Yeah, your epithelium, that area can grow back.
Like a starfish.
Yeah. Some people get scarring. Some people get lucky. It's the same as the corneal abrasions that we were talking about earlier. Some people get the scratch on the cornea, it makes an abrasion, and then it doesn't heal. It becomes a corneal ulcer.
Yeah.
Other people, like, you're a good healer, it sounds like, Chaz, that, like, your body just healed it itself, which is what you want.
It took years.
You were holy at one point.
Yeah.
It could take a long time.
Kathy in Wallingford.
Good morning. How about a detached retina?
Yes, that's on the list. That's my number six. So people come in with detached retinas fairly often, where they get flashes of light and then they'll have visual changes. They generally need a retinal specialist, but some people can get floaters in these flashers. But the retina can detach for a number of different reasons, either hypertension, trauma, other things that can happen in the back of the eye. But you think of the retina as the TV screen that you're able to see everything with. Without your retina, you can't see. Generally people have a little corneal or a piece of the retina that's detaching from the back of the eye, and it needs a retinal specialist. In Connecticut, there's not, believe it or not, a lot of people who do retina surgeries and specialty by itself, so they need a very specific doctor to help them.
Damn.
And we always have somebody on call for us, for the ophthalmology service, for the eye doctor service, to get them to the right place or to get the doctor to come into the ER if need be.
There was actually an optical specialist in the ER when I took my husband in.
Yeah, that's lucky that if they were there, that's very lucky that they were there.
Why'd you hit him?
Well, in the ER, they wanted to ask if they could do a breathalyzer test on him. And I'm like, why? He said, because he's the only sober one here. It's Saturday night.
Oh. Why are you sober?
Thank you, Kathy.
Thank you.
All right. And we're going to wrap it up.
Okay. You want me to go through the list?
Yes. Top 10 eyeball problems that bring patients to the ER.
All right. Number one was conjunctivitis. Number two is glaucoma when you have increased eye pressure. Number three was hyphema, which is an eight ball eye when you get blood in the anterior, in the front of the eye from trauma.
Oh.
That's not good. Number four is corneal abrasion, the scratch on the eye. Number five was precepto or orbital cellulitis, which is when you get an infection around your eye or in your eye. Number six was the retinal detachment we just spoke about. Number seven is a central retinal artery occlusion where the blood vessel of the eye can get obstructed. That's like having a stroke to the eye. Number eight is the foreign bodies we talked about in the eye. Number nine is eye trauma with orbital fractures or ruptured globe. And number 10 is my favorite, which is a lady who got her eyes super glued shut that I had to get unshut with some mineral oil. And when the eye started to open back up, the tears that were backed up in her eyes started to flow out like a water fountain.
Oh! Is what they said.
Yeah, it was impressive. That's the only person. I'll remember that lady forever.
Ruined your shirt.
He's seen it all, and he'll remember that one forever.
Ruined my shirt.
Dr. Ron Clark, Associate Chief of Emergency Medicine, the Hospital of Central Connecticut, New Britain General Campus. Also author of Surviving the Emergency Room on Amazon.
Yeah.
Get this book.
Yeah. Definitely.
Know it.
Yep.
Yeah, it's a good book to have.
Yep.
Doc, thank you very much.
You're welcome. You guys have a great day.
You too. Well, thank you. Went to the Jay the Iceman Picarillo service Friday. So I left here a little early.
Yeah.
And shot right there. Because it started at 11, and although it's only like a 15-minute ride from the studio, I knew people were going to be getting there very early.
Oh, yeah.
For sure.
And I wanted a seat. And we were lucky.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. We had a whole plan. You know, it's like, we're going to pull up to the church. You're going to get out. You're going to go in.
Right.
Get a seat. And I'm going to go park a mile away.
Right. You had to have a plan. Yeah.
And I said, listen, you're going to know a lot of people. So, Jennifer, if you stop and start talking to people on the way into the church.
No seats.
Yeah. And we don't get a seat. You failed.
Oh. No pressure.
Failed.
Now go. You have your mission. Now go.
You have your mission.
Right.
I pull up, drop and roll.
Right.
Tuck and roll.
Right. You slow down to 30.
Yeah. Oh, my God. So many people. And I was so glad because as I'm pulling up, Jennifer's like, it's fine. I'll just park wherever you park. I'm like, no. Let's stick to the plan. I let her out. I start driving. And I could see it's waves of people coming from every side street as I'm going down the park. I'm like, I'm telling you, by the time if she doesn't get right in there, we're not going to have any seats.
Go. Yeah.
And I was right. We got there. It was like 10:20 and you're done.
Yeah.
You're done.
Quick. Yeah.
I
quick.
Saved a seat for somebody. Pat Maddow was on the other side of the church from Oddfellas. And I said, he said, hey, I have two over here. I said, hold them for my friend Mark from Station 25. He was out catering for people. You know, just good. It was a festival of awesome people, people with good hearts.
Yeah.
You know, who Jay, through his kindness, brought all these people into his gravitational orbit.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
And, you know, it's one person after another you run into.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you couldn't make it. You had treatment.
Yeah, I wanted to be there so bad.
Yeah.
Yeah. I saw a lot of footage, though. Boy, what a beautiful send-off. I mean, they really came through for him.
The one thing, you know, I was torn because, like, I know Jay or knew Jay personally.
Yeah.
And I know that he would be okay with this, but I'm like, some people might not be, and I don't want to get into that on social media.
Yeah.
But there was, you know, beautiful flowers from a lot of people.
Yeah.
And one of the arrangements was this massive flower piece made of the KISS logo.
Yeah, wasn't that cool?
Oh, wow.
That was cool.
Why, was that online?
Jay loved KISS, yeah. I seen pictures. I saw pictures of it, yeah.
Oh, so other people took pictures.
Yeah.
See, I wanted to take, I'm like, I don't feel right.
Oh, yeah, no, people took pictures, they took video.
Okay.
Yeah.
The post, the post had pictures, and that's how I saw it. It was completely packed out, which I thought was great. The whole, they had a shot.
It was standing room.
Oh, yeah. It was great.
Standing full at the back of the church, probably like three or four deep, and then people were standing from the back of the church all the way up the sides.
All along the sides.
Of the church. Yes. And, you know, it was just incredible. And the priest was phenomenal. The way he spoke, he integrated Jay's life and wrestling and
with the Bible.
And just with the Bible. It was spectacular.
Oh, he took, and there was a lot of writing going on there. That he did a great job. This wasn't just, now I'm going to read you this excerpt from the Bible and mention something about Jay. This was, he, like Jennifer said, took Jay's life and the story of the Bible and intertwined it.
Wow.
Like, that's amazing. Oh, this guy's good.
Wow.
I should get his number,
right?
You know, like, as a,
you go. You plan on going?
He could do mine,
right?
And you know, as a Roman Catholic service goes, they'll always offer communion. And I said to Chaz, I'm like, "There's no way they're going to offer communion to everyone here." I mean, there were several hundred people, and sure enough, they offered communion to the entire parish, and most people went, and I said, this is going to take forever. They were so efficient, they banged it out, and then after that, everybody sat, prayed, and then as they were headed towards the end of the service, Gennaro, his son, got up and spoke, and this young man spoke so beautifully.
16 years old.
Whoa.
Beautifully. I mean, like he has experienced public speaking. It was just, he was incredible.
Well, think about who his dad was.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then he was just talking about different experiences with his dad and KISS and just different things growing up. And then he became very emotional towards the end of his speech. And then
talked about the prom, and he said, "My dad won't be there for the prom."
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, and then he got very emotional, and he apologized, and he really was trying to keep it together. And everybody's like, "Oh, it's okay, General, go ahead, go ahead." And everybody started clapping.
And we all stood up.
Standing ovation. Yeah.
It was something.
Yeah.
He's going to wear his dad's leather to the prom.
Nice.
Well, nice. Yeah.
He's a good kid.
That's a big responsibility to put on, you know, not put on, but like to have that put on you as a 16-year-old. And good on him for doing it and everybody else for supporting, like getting up and clapping and really doing that. That helped him get through.
Well, he wrote, like,
there were a
number of headlines in this eulogy that he wrote about his dad. I'm like, this kid is a very good writer.
Really? Wow.
And, you know, Jay was very, very good at speaking in public.
Yeah.
This kid, he's right there.
No good.
Wow.
And he said, "My dad was a wrestler, a rock star, and a local hero." And I thought, that's a headline.
It is.
And it was a lot of those.
It definitely is.
Intertwined in there. Then his sister got up, and I thought, man, I wouldn't want to come on after... the kid.
Yeah.
I'm like, they should have flip-flopped this.
Right.
She should have went up first. But then she gets up and maybe working from notes, but felt like it was all from the heart. It sounded like it was just her just talking.
Yeah.
She was incredible.
Wow.
She was amazing.
Oh my God, I can see why she's second.
Yeah.
Yeah, and she was just talking about different things, you know, different brother-sister things that you just drive each other crazy and funny experiences growing up. And she said that, you know, she's like, Jade said to her once that, you know, if I go, he's like, "You've got to make my eulogy huge.
You got to make it big." No, but she got a lot of laughs, and she knew how to land jokes, and it was just natural.
Yeah.
She just had a natural storytelling ability, and she talked about how, you know, when KISS went on its, you know, farewell tour.
Right.
It's like, Jay was like, "We got to go, sis. We got to go."
Yeah.
So we went. Then they came back around to think about it. And she said, "You know, I can't keep going to these farewell tours."
Right. That's great.
Yeah, it was really meaningful. And one of the things she said, and I thought, wow, this is the Jay that I knew. Because he had this childlike enthusiasm about him.
Yep.
And she said, you know, Mom and I were always worried about Jay because of his beautiful nature of wanting to help people. And we would say, Jay, not everyone's like you. Not everyone's trying to help you.
Yeah.
Got to be careful. I'm like, that is the Jay I knew. He was just so kind and loving.
Yeah.
You could see the wrong people would take advantage of that.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And yeah, it was a very beautiful, fitting send off to a local hero.
Yep. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I've never seen so many men cry in one space, and I don't know what it is. It's just whenever I see a grown man cry, I don't even have to know what it's about. It would make me cry. It was just everybody.
Yeah, but I cry at stupid things. Like some of these guys are like, these are real men.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Right. Like they could probably say, yeah, I haven't cried since I was two.
Right. Right.
You know?
Yeah.
I got a tattoo when I was three.
Right. Yeah. I dropped my ice cream cone.
Yeah, like some of these guys who are crying, I'm like, oh man, this is we're all going here.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. These guys cry, yeah.
Yeah. So
wow.
But and then, you know, I was looking through my photos right before we took a post and I couldn't find a really good picture of me and Jay together. And then someone out of the blue sent Jennifer this really great. I'm like, oh man, I'm gonna have this one forever. I'm gonna put this one in a frame.
Oh wow.
Great picture of me and Jay.
Yeah, my friend Christine Fensky, she messaged me on Facebook yesterday. She says, I don't know if Chaz has this picture, but I saw this picture and I thought he might like to have it. And it was just a great selfie of the two of you.
Oh, it's an awesome picture. Well, Jay, wherever you are, man.
Yep.
We're going to miss you every second. Love you. All right. I'm going to hang up on you.
Hey, love you, bye.
Love you. How a tactic in the Karen Reed murder trial could play out in the Waterbury stepmom case. Let's bring on attorney Norm Pattis. How you doing?
Hey, I'm well. How are you? Good morning.
Good, thanks. So, I don't know, AJ, if you're following this Karen Reed trial at all.
Right.
It's her second trial.
Okay.
Okay. The first one was a hung jury.
Right.
And so it's starting all over again. She's accused of killing her boyfriend, hitting him with a car on a snowy night. Drunken argument. She backs into him, leaves him for dead. There's a lot of evidence to suggest that this is what happened.
Yeah.
But then there's a lot of evidence that there may have been a police cover-up because he died going to a house party of a Boston police officer.
Okay.
So they're saying the cops... You know, there's a lot of cell phone data and other Google searches and stuff that's like, It's funny. It's one of those cases. I watched the opening arguments from both, and the prosecution went first. I'm like, you could stop right now. Take a vote. She's she's good. I've heard enough.
Yeah.
And then the defense attorney got up. I'm like, ooh.
Wait a minute.
I have reasonable doubt.
And, you know, now, and this ties into the stepmom case, she never testified in the original trial, but they're using things she has said in interviews now. So this is why I'm guessing you would advise a client not to speak to anyone.
Yeah, that's the typical advice is, you know, make the state pay for every word they get from you, get something in exchange. And, you know, the Reed case, as in all high profile cases, the media is all over it. And the temptation to say something is irresistible. You want to be careful what you say and make sure you stay on point and on script. Unbelievably, I don't know if this is true, but I read somewhere that they let a film crew, maybe a cable news outfit, accompany them as they prepared for trial and observe them. You know, that raises serious questions about the attorney-client privilege, whether it's been waived, and just what's going on. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see what they use of Ms. Reed's. And, you know, what you say, you know, you see that thing, you know, anything you say can and will be used against you. What a defendant says in the world at large is what's called an admission of a party opponent. intent or perhaps an admission against penal interest. And both of those are admissible. That is, they can come into evidence against a person accused. The defense doesn't get to offer her statements, her out-of-court statements, because those are called hearsay. However, there's a wrinkle, and I just don't know whether the defense is going to need to use it in this case, but that is, the statement against penal interest is always admissible. In other words, I don't mean to get into the weeds too far, but it's deemed reliable. You wouldn't say something that could potentially hurt you unless it's true. Well, I don't see why she doesn't get to offer that testimony. I don't see why she doesn't get to offer her own testimony of being at the scene when the man went in, you know, when she dropped him off, or whether she grazed him or whether she didn't, you know. Those are against penal interest because it puts her at the scene of where he died. And so I think her lawyers need to do some serious thinking and some thinking outside the box to figure out how to use these statements.
The information they have, putting and they intertwined all the information they have, cell phone. Mm. They have the black box of the car.
Oh.
And they have the temperature of the cell phone battery, which I don't think they had in the first trial.
Oh.
So they have the time of the temperature, and you could see, huh, as he was laying out in the snow dying, the temperature of the battery was going down.
Oh.
They have the movement of the cell phone.
Interesting.
The steps.
Yeah.
Not necessarily steps, but if you move at all.
Yeah.
So they're able to intertwine all of these things,
wow,
with the acceleration of the car. Shortly after that, it was the last time he moved.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's a compelling narrative. But, you know, I hadn't paid much attention to the trial first time out. You and I were talking the other day, Chaz, and you asked me about it. And so last week I spent a couple hours looking at what I could find, and I began to doubt the state's case. I don't doubt that she behaved irresponsibly, but I don't know that you can prove that she killed him. I mean, for example, he had a fractured skull and a 2-inch laceration in the back of his head. That doesn't happen typically from getting hit by a car and knocked into a snowbank. More telling still, on one of his arms, he had what looked to be a dozen or so dog bites or scratches. And significantly, the homeowners moved the dog out of state, presumably so there could be no DNA testing to match the bites and scratches to the arm. Mm. So it looks to me like she may have behaved irresponsibly, but there may be serious questions as to whether she caused his death. And that's what it takes to prove a murder.
That combined with all of the police conversations and texts and phone calls that they denied, but they were, you know, they had to really search and dig for these cell phone records. There's enough reasonable doubt here for her to walk. I'd be shocked if they're able to convict her. Now, she may have actually hit him and killed him,
right?
But there's just too much reasonable doubt. Don't you agree?
Well, let's be careful about saying hit him and kill him. She may have hit him, but she may not have killed him. Causation has, you know, it takes more than one. Often there can be multiple causes of an event. So I had a case years ago in which someone beat his girlfriend. And shortly after the beating, she was discovered to have a traumatic brain injury. So the first response of the state was, you caused that brain injury. You're going to jail forever. On investigation, she'd been involved in a head-on car collision a month earlier. And the results of the medical testing there suggested that may have been a factor in her traumatic brain injury. It didn't excuse what the client did. He still went to jail, but rather than going to jail for 10 or 12 years, he went to jail for 4. In the Reed case, she may well have collided with him and left him in a snowbank, but I doubt very seriously that she caused the laceration to the back of his head. I doubt she gnawed on his arm or scratched on his arm. And the inability to give complete answers to those questions by the occupants of the home,
right,
together with the suspicious activity of the police department, may give the jury reason to doubt whether she caused his death. So the defense can argue that, yes, she should have stayed, and if she'd stayed, she could have saved his life because she could have kept him from going into that house and getting beaten to death. That would be a defense theme that is worth pursuing, in my view.
Yeah, it's weird, too, because the body was, like, flat on his back,
uh-huh,
and arms on his side.
Huh.
Like, weird.
Like someone placed him there.
He was knocked out of his shoe. They tested the shoe.
Yeah.
DNA of 5 different guys.
Really?
5 different male
DNA. But he'd been in a bar that night. So, I mean, you know.
Okay.
You know.
Okay.
You know, and I'm less persuaded by that. It was the wounds. It was the wounds that did it for me. You know, I mean, she doesn't help herself. I mean, she's got those psychopathic eyes, you know, when you see her, like, all lit up during the
By the way, thinking, social yeah, media woman, loves the, like, the crazy eyes.
Right. Yeah. That woman could kill you over a grilled cheese sandwich. Yeah. But, you know, I don't know that she killed this cop that night with her car. And that's what the case is, you know.
Sad story. I feel for the family.
Yeah.
They're not going to get justice in this.
No.
There's no way. How would you feel about this if you were defending her? You'd feel pretty good, right? That, I mean, there's enough reasonable doubt for her to walk.
You know, you never feel good with a jury. You know, here's what happens in jury selection, at least, or in a criminal trial. Jurors walk in the room and they don't walk in saying, I wonder what the state can prove here. They wonder what the defendant did. And then they start to bend circumstantial evidence in the direction of a narrative consistent with guilt. So the presumption of innocence is one thing, and it means something, and it's important. Proof beyond a reasonable doubt is a high legal standard. But I have my doubts about whether jurors really follow the law. I think that they ask themselves, how did this guy end up here? What did he do to end up here? And that's the wrong question for a jury. The real question should be, what does the state allege, and can the state prove it, and are there reasons to doubt it?
Yeah, there's a lot of, you know, I'm just watching clips of the various witnesses testifying, and the defense is doing a good job at making them either look like dopes or liars.
Well, the clips are intoxicating. It's just one after another.
Yeah.
The circumstances are so bizarre sometimes.
Yeah.
I wonder whether she's going to testify this time. You know, I mean, you know, and you led earlier with a comparison to the Waterbury stepmom case. You know, I've suggested before that her trial lawyer may want to consider having her sit for an interview so that her version of events is out there and then dare the state to use it. You know, if the state selects only isolated portions of her testimony, the defense might be able to move in other pieces under something called the rule of completeness. You know, you don't get to offer just an isolated statement. You have to offer the statement in context. So a carefully conducted interview could go a long way toward helping the stepmom.
I don't think
know whether it helped Karen Reed.
I don't think she would do a good job.
No.
Like, you had this situation.
Let me put you on the spot, Jez.
Okay.
If she looked like Karen Reed, do you think she'd do a good job?
No, it's not that. It's that I don't, I've talked to other people in that orbit.
You've never heard her speak?
And, no, I haven't heard her speak, no.
She could be a compelling speaker.
I mean, secondhand hearsay that she's a dope. Okay.
And you think Karen Reed is a genius?
No, I don't think she's a genius. No, and I don't mean disrespect by she's a dope, but I just mean she's not highly intelligent, and she's kind of rough around the edges, and I don't think she's going to do herself any good.
Gotcha.
You know, we've talked to people who have worked with her, who knew her.
Yeah. True.
Not good. And we've talked to people right around that orbit in that circle. I don't think it'd be great. Now, were you the one who decided that it was okay for photostoolists to sit down and do an interview?
You know, I'm not supposed to talk about that.
Oh, that's right. Sorry.
Because I ended up getting sued.
Right.
So I'm not going to, just going to honor the agreement I made. But I mean, when it comes time for to testify or talk to the press, it's always the client's decision. You know, a lawyer can advise on the tactical ups and downs and risks of pursuing a certain course of conduct. But no lawyer in his right mind would say to a client, oh, whatever you want to do is fine with me. A lawyer would say, you know, these are the risks, these are the benefits, and how do we best prepare? With the Waterbury stepmom, I would prepare her for such an interview as though she were going to be testifying in court and cross-examined. And I would give her suggestions about how to respond to various themes that I knew I could live with in the jury's presence. And I wouldn't have any hesitancy, you know, to stop the interview if I didn't like how it was going. Years ago, I had a case in Manhattan. It was the Manhattan madam, or the soccer mom madam. and we sat for a number of interviews, including one with Dr. Phil. And Dr. Phil was just intent to have her on the show. So he wrote her a check for $120,000 for two interviews. And we go to the first interview, and we had negotiated with his producers about the contours of the interview. And at one point, I thought Dr. Phil went too far. So I said, whoa, we're not going there. And he got all upset, you know, and he starts passing his outline across the table. We agreed, blah, 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 this, that, and the other thing. And I'm sitting there thinking, oh, my God, they're going to cancel the check. You know, I'm going to get sued by my client. But in the end, they wanted her more than we wanted their money. And so they gave in to what we wanted. And I think that's the thing you have to realize in a case of this. When the world's knocking at your door, it's not because they think you are so charming. They want access to your client, and they will take what you give them. And so don't give too much, and make sure you give what you can use, and give some thought to what you want your client to look like, consistent with the truth, obviously, in a jury's presence.
There's a little bit of their defense starting to creep its way into public domain now. The defense attorney, who will be on the show tomorrow, in an interview, said once, and I thought, oh, this could stick.
Okay.
She was never the custodial parent, and the dad was there the whole time.
Yeah.
And up until the last year. And I thought, that's a good one. In fact, that's the only thing I'd say anytime anyone asked any question about her. It was like, she was never the custodial parent.
No, but she was in the house. She didn't have to have custodial parent. I mean, she didn't have the legal.
That's a whole different charge, though.
Yeah.
Witnessing is one thing. Doing that is another. No?
Well, I mean, tell that to the next guy who gets whacked up in a drug conspiracy because he drove the car while somebody else sold it.
No, part of the crime.
But that could support a conspiracy charge. I mean, I understand. I think the best defense for her, and I haven't met her, haven't talked to her. My office represents her in a limited capacity on appeal of the conditions of the ankle bracelet in the appellate court. No decision there yet. But here's my prediction. The defense is going to be troubled child, difficult with discipline. The father amped down, doubled down. The mom had reservations, but went along because the husband was overbearing and abusive. When the husband died, she panicked and didn't know how to get out. And it was a sort of battered woman sort of defense. That's what I predict will happen. Yeah.
Yeah.
And now, it's not going
to. Look, I don't want her to walk, but I'm saying if I'm defending her, it's the dad. The dad was in the house.
That's where you're going, right.
That's the there's a famous line among lawyers, some other dude did it defense, you know, and that's always an option. And in this case, the other dude was her husband. But she was there, you know, and what steps did she take to prevent it? And when he died, why didn't she stop it? That would be the prosecution's response.
Now, every time this attorney talks to somebody, he says, my client did nothing wrong. Yeah. And I think he's got to change that, too. My client did not do what she's being charged with. Mm-hmm. I think when people hear him say, my client did nothing wrong, they're like, you're a liar.
They're put off by that.
Because she was in the house. She saw how bad this kid was.
Yeah.
And she looked the other way. She did something wrong.
Right.
Just not what she was charged with, because this portrays him as a liar. It's like, you're lying to us now.
Right.
What else are you going to lie to us about?
Gotcha.
It's a hard defense to put on with a jury. I recall one year I had a bondswoman in Danbury. She was accused of, you know, taking about $200,000 from a guy she shouldn't have taken it from. And the state blew the statute of limitations in our view. And it was an arguable question. The judge was going to decide it post-trial. And the closing argument was, my client's a thief, but they charged her with the wrong crime. I said, if I could put the state of Connecticut on the witness stand, this is what I'd do. And I looked at the witness stand and I said, what the hell were you thinking when you brought this crazy charge? You know, and where were you when it mattered? And the jury laughed and we won. You
nice.
Know, it's
wow.
a risky defense. But sometimes you got to take big risks to get a big win.
Attorney Norm Pattis, thanks for coming on. Real quick.
Thanks for having me.
Yes or no, do you think we have a serial killer in New England?
Not according to what I read in the paper this morning. You mentioned we might talk about that this morning, so I looked at recent stories. I think we have a number of missing people and suspicious deaths, but there's no real modus operandi. There's no real link between the crimes, at least none that law enforcement are talking about. I think that when horrible things happen, people grope for meaning, hence conspiracy theories.
Yeah.
I think that the serial killer riff is a conspiracy theory right now. But let's see. Let's let the evidence unfold.
All right. Anthony in Brantford.
Hey, I heard you guys talking about x-rays.
Yes.
Back in the 90s, I worked at a hospital, and this was before computers. And they had literally millions of x-rays they would ask us to go looking for. Sometimes in the basement, sometimes we had to go to a place down the street because they had so many of them. And one of the ones that I remember seeing was a cleaver. It was a cleaver that was stuck in somebody's head. Somebody smashed a cleaver into somebody's head from the top. And you could see the whole thing. I mean, it was like the cleaver was right through his head. It went straight down, almost looked like it was in his mouth.
Wow.
But it came down from the top in.
So that person died, right?
I don't know what happened to it, to be honest with you. I would think so, the way it looked.
Sounds like it was deep enough in.
It was a split decision.
Yeah, right.
It was almost like it was through his head from the top down. So I don't know exactly how he did, but somebody killed him or tried to kill him.
I'll give him a piece of my mind.
Left brain or right brain. There were millions of x-rays, and I've seen a lot of things on a lot of different things in different places, let's say.
Did you ever see that x-ray that was circulating around 1998? AJ and I were doing, one of these phone subjects on this kind of thing.
Yeah.
And somebody called in who worked in the x-ray department and said, I have an x-ray of a guy who put a light bulb somewhere where he shouldn't.
Right.
Have.
Oh.
Where the sun don't shine.
He had a bright idea.
But he put it the big way first.
Glass first.
Right.
Yeah.
Glass first.
Not your standard candelabra way.
You didn't screw it in. Like
it's like a chandelier in your kitchen. Yeah.
I have an idea.
I've never seen a light bulb there, but I did see some sort of an animal because you could see the you could see the bones of the animal.
What?
An X-ray. That is one thing that I saw.
Of an animal inside of a...
Apparently doesn't digest properly.
Like a gerbil or something. It was a small animal, but you could see the bones on the x-ray where it was.
Well, wow. Facts, no pants on, some of these things happen.
They always said that was an urban legend and it's real.
Right.
Yeah, wow. No. I definitely would.
Yeah, that name on the X-ray, was it R. Stewart
or Gear?
R. Gear. That's it. Yeah. Rod Stewart was a different.
Right.
Yeah, we don't even want to talk about that.
No. Okay, yeah.
Jeez.
Armageddon.
No.
You folks have a good day.
You too. Thank you,
Anthony. Thank you.
Well, the greatest hits.
Nobody actually brought the x-ray into the studio.
Yeah,
it wasn't like
it.
A fixed picture.
Yeah.
Oh. Like now you don't know what to believe on the internet, but this was an actual x-ray he brought in.
Yeah. Wasn't he's getting in there. Yeah. Took us a delicate touch.
You would think that the bulb would break.
You would think.
Like, I'd be very relaxed.
Right? Obviously very relaxed. Yes. Yeah. Right.
They made a whole episode of Scrubs, the comedy show, about
I love that
the
show.
Light bulb. There was a whole episode where I think the janitor was pretending to be a doctor. But
no, there was a lost and found, and he was looking for a gift for his girlfriend at the time, and he found something. They're like, oh, no, you took it from the butt bin?
Yeah, yeah.
Stuff that was, they take out of people.
It wasn't a lost and found.
Wow.
But, yeah, they had the X-ray. They definitely had, I remember Scrubs had an X-ray of a guy with a light bulb, and it was like a reference.
It was based on the story.
It must have been.
Exactly.
It had to have been.
Right. It must have been.
You pull his finger, it goes off. A little more lighting. Okay, we're good.
It's a bright spot in the back of your pants.
Right. Hey, butt light, get over here. No, I said butt light, not butt light.
We don't have a lost and found. Oh, no. Right.
Hello? Anyone in there?
I have an idea.
Let there be light. Oh, no. Right.
Let there be light.
Just a fart.
Marty, back to you.
Hey, guys. Jennifer. Hey, Dad, you didn't mention the guy's name. You didn't mention the guy's name. His name was Rod. And in layman's terminology, he had a rodectomy.
Right.
That's how they fixed him.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So when you filmed that, the Iceman, was that at Good Morning America in New York?
We didn't film it.
What do you mean you didn't film it?
We didn't film it.
Did you have it in New York City at Good Morning America?
You know, I've been doing this for a long time, and I know that nothing is going to come out of this. Nothing. Like, I see no potential future for this break.
Right.
All right, I'll tell you what I'm going to do.
Okay.
I'm going to stump your chumps at what time? 9:30?
9:30, yes. 9:30.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you can do that.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
Have you ever had an object stuck in your body? Like, did you have to go to get an X-ray?
No, I didn't have an. I had an X-ray. A fat guy jumped on my right arm, and I had 3 compound fractures.
I knew him in emergency room right. would bring us stories.
Right.
Yeah,
he hasn't lived a clean life.
No,
a lot of visits. A lot, and you guys got my little workup when Jennifer called me. It was probably too.
It was Ruth.
Ruth. You guys.
That's Ruth.
Can you tell who did the talking during the conversation?
Yeah, Jennifer called me.
Ruth. It was Ruth.
Ruth.
Was you?
Ruth.
You sound like a broad then.
Your name's Ruth. It isn't. Oh, my God.
Okay. Right.
Marty. Hold on, Marty. Have you ever been attacked by a bobcat?
Nope.
This guy has.
Oh,
damn.
Chaz and AJ in the morning, 99.1 PLR. Claude Struther is on. Not only is he a man who was attacked by a bobcat, he's an 82-year-old man attacked by a bobcat.
Okay.
And he's still alive.
See?
Lucky you, Claude.
Well, thank you. No, I was lucky, and, you know, that's just part of my problem. I'm fighting stage 4 lung cancer.
Wow.
And so I'm pretty weak. I kind of escaped. I wasn't supposed to be going in the woods by myself, but my wife went out of town, so I said, what the heck, you know, I might as well give it a try. So that's what I was doing in the woods, giving it a try.
Okay, that's a ballsy thing. Stage 4, 82.
Yeah.
Let me go in the woods by myself to go turkey hunting.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm pretty hard-headed.
Yeah.
All right, well, you want to live your life, too.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, but I just made a mistake with my setup. I sat by 2 small trees with my back and head exposed.
Oh.
Instead of by a big tree, and I was slowly watching a hardwood bottom and nothing moving but my head slowly back and forth. So, you know, I laid the table for him. I did, you know, and he took it. And but he hit so hard, the good thing about it, my head's still kind of hurting. He hit so hard, it stunned him too. And he released before his fangs got deep in my neck and the claws, you know, real deep in my face. It stunned him, and he just bounded on over. And I thought somebody hit me with a baseball bat, and I turned back and threw up my arm to stop the next blow, and nothing was there. Then I looked forward, and there he was, trotting off. And he's just doing his thing. He's just trying to make a living, get a meal.
Right.
I got no grudge against him whatsoever.
Right.
I
wouldn't have shot him. You were turkey hunting, so you had a rifle. What'd you have, a shotgun?
Shotgun.
Yeah.
And perfect camouflage. And
well, not good enough to hide from a bobcat.
So he must took you for something else, basically.
Yeah. But he just saw that head moving. And
were you tempted a little bit to fire a shot his way?
Like a laser pointer.
Never.
Never.
I don't shoot bobcats, foxes, otters, or beavers. They were here before I was, and I'm very protective on my land of those animals.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
Very nice.
Good for you.
Yeah.
But turkeys, that's a whole other story.
Right, well, those taste good.
Turkeys and squirrels. I have quite a squirrel hunt every year. All my buddies come to the country. We squirrel hunt and we turkey hunt, and that's about it.
Do you eat what you kill?
What do you use for squirrel hunting?
Well, we used to use .22 rifles till we all got too old, and now we use .410 shotguns. We got where we couldn't hit with a rifle.
Is there any squirrel left?
Yeah, it's slush.
It's like squirrel confetti. There's a squirrel over here and over there.
Do you eat the squirrels?
Yeah. We tenderize them and fry them and just as good as a good piece of chicken if you prepare it correctly.
I've heard it tastes like chicken, yeah.
No.
I'd rather have chicken.
We got a real-life badass on the phone right now.
Seriously.
Yeah. Claude Struther, 82 years old.
stage 4 cancer, goes hunting by himself, and gets attacked by a bobcat and lives to talk about it.
Yeah.
That picture you took, how soon after the attack was that? Your head is all bloodied.
I guess maybe a minute.
Wow.
As soon as I got my breath back.
Did you think that picture might be it for you, or you were confident that you were going to make it?
I knew I was going to make it. I just had to get my wind back. I didn't walk far. I can't walk very far. I didn't have but about 100 yards to get to my truck. Got a little doctor, a nice doctor in the little community, so I called them, and they cleaned me up before I went to the big doctor and got my shots. And I didn't tell them it bit me in the back of the head because I was afraid they're going to make me take, what you call them, rabies. But so far, it's been 9 days.
Okay.
I got my fingers crossed.
So you rolled the dice with that one.
Seriously, yeah.
I rolled the dice with that. Okay. You know, you hear about sticking a needle in your stomach. I've had a lot of shots, but I hadn't had one in the stomach yet.
Yeah. I think they've changed that.
Yeah, I think it's different now.
I think it's different.
It? Not look forward to, but, you know.
Yeah, they just have a raccoon bite, you know.
Right.
Yeah. But if he'd have come back aggressive, I would have shot it. But, right. You know, he just wanted to get away. You know, the odds were pretty slim. And so I decided to gamble on that one.
Yeah.
Do you think you were in more danger with that bobcat? Or when you told your wife you went out hunting by yourself?
she can't do anything with me. She tried for 56 years. She tries, but I do better now. But yeah, now she just shook her head.
That's why the bobcat left.
She's used to you.
The bobcat went, oh, your wife, oh, God.
Where are you from? You sound like you're from Louisiana.
Well, I'm not. I'm from a rural county in Alabama, Wilcox County, which is a county that my wife says it's in a time warp.
Oh.
It's 30, 40 years behind the rest of Alabama. And
you know what?
We all talk the same, all of us, the whites, the blacks. We just came up with that. Never didn't anybody ever leave, and we all ended up talking the same. And but it's a nice timber and cattle, but a nice little place.
Were you ever in the military?
I was in the National Guard for 6 years.
Well, thank you for your service.
Yeah, thank you, sir.
That's cool.
So how many squirrels do you think you shot with a shotgun? And what's it like eating them? Is the squirrel full of pellets?
Is it a good recipe?
Pick out the shrimp.
Well, that's why we always shot them with rifles, to cut down on the pellets. But, when all my buddies, most of them are 80, the ones that are still alive. But you just don't bite right down real hard and break a tooth because you're going to hit one occasionally. But we have, a lot of folks come when we cook them. We'll fry up a bunch of them and have friends come. It's a little gathering. We've got a place in the country. It's a peaceful little town, a camp house, and just getting together,
Do you bread them and everything? Have like a little nut sauce to dip them in?
Acorn sauce.
Oh, yeah. Nice. Just like chicken.
Nice.
Yeah, but you got to kill like 50 of them to have,
like one plate.
Oh, yeah. We'll kill that many.
Really?
Oh, really?
Wow. Yeah,
it'll be 8 or 10 of us. We pretty rough on them.
Squirrel fest.
How do you get it? What, do you put some feed out or something?
No, I got a lot of old hardwood, oak, and hickory timber on my property. And you got to have old trees to have squirrels. They need hollows to nest in.
Yeah.
So I really have a great habitat for squirrels and a couple of creeks that run through the property. So I just have a lot of squirrels. I do. And I'm just lucky.
I I went hunting when I was 9 years old. I got my first 22. And I went hunting with my dad and my brothers and their crazy friends. And there were some yahoos, you know, like the weapons you wouldn't go hunting with, right. Like a Thompson 45 caliber, right. 50 round clip machine gun, an M1 AK-47. Yeah, like these are not the things you hunt with. So we're out there, we're walking, it's like hours, haven't seen anything. You know, it's probably all the loud talking and the cigarette smoking.
Probably, yeah.
You know, like no animal. Animals heard us 10 miles away.
Right, they left.
Finally, we see this one squirrel.
Oh, no.
And it's like, oh, man, this is a bad day for me.
My goose is cooked.
It runs right in front of us, and then it goes up inside this hollow tree.
Oh, no.
They must have expended like 700 rounds on this tree. They blew the tree down. Yeah. I think the squirrel lived.
He got out of there.
He played toothpicks.
Wow. Well, Claude, I'm glad you survived.
Yeah.
And now your next job is to kick cancer's ass.
Yeah, please do
that's
that.
That's right. Yeah, the doctors, they encouraged, and you know, I've been on chemo for 8 months, and that stuff just wears on you.
Yeah, it does.
You know, yep. It gets worse each time, but I can stand 3 more months of it, I guess.
Good.
You got this. Yeah,
you can do it.
Keep it up, brother.
You got this.
And my buddies are calling me now. I have a big fishing deal every year at the end of May, and they won't tell me. They don't care. Long as I can get there and stay in the bed, they'll do the fishing. They won't after me to put it on the schedule.
Just shoot the fish.
Good friends. Yeah, just throw a grenade.
Just shoot the fish.
All friends.
We're going to check back in with you at some point, Claude. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, thank y'all.
Hey, Central Ohio. The Nationwide Children's Marathon will be taking over the city on October 18th and 19th. COTA riders can expect significant reroutes throughout the city. Operators will be working tirelessly to assist COTA customers. That's October 18th and 19th for the Nationwide Children's Marathon. Expect significant reroutes downtown. You can view real-time updates on the transit app or at COTA.com. That's COTA.com. Good luck to all the runners.
When it comes to showing appreciation, the gift you choose says everything. Minky Couture luxury blankets make the perfect statement. Soft, stylish, and unforgettable. Whether you're thanking a client, rewarding an employee, or celebrating a milestone, nothing delivers warmth and gratitude like a Minky blanket. With custom options and elegant packaging, your gift will stand out and be remembered long after the moment has passed. Make your corporate gifting extraordinary. With Minky Couture, luxury you can feel. Visit minkycouture.com to get started.